I'm beginning to record now. My numbers are going up, so I know that this is happening.
Great. So you're confirmed you're recording.
Yes.
I'm recording on my end.
I'm going to turn down now, so there's no bleed, but I can still hear you.
Look at you, so professional. And then I'm going to do just a backup on Zoom.
Okay.
So you're about to get probably that little thing.
Got it.
Okay.
Okay.
Amazing. That was me and Angela Garbus, my guest today, getting set up for this talk. Angela is the author of Like a Mother, an NPR Best Book of the Year, and finalist for the Washington State Book Award in Nonfiction. Her most recent book, Essential Labor, Mothering as Social Change, came out last month and is already a national bestseller. Angela's work has also appeared in The New York Times, The Cut, Bon Appetit, and New York Magazine. Angela has been featured on NPR's Fresh Air and co-hosted The Double Shift, an acclaimed podcast challenging the status quo of motherhood in America. She lives with her family in Seattle. My conversation with Angela is the first in a series of four conversations I'm having all about appetite. In talking to four different people with varying perspectives about and experiences with their appetites, I'm learning what it is to be someone with an unapologetic appetite. Angela and I cover so much in this conversation, including a variety of ways to think about appetites, and also varying definitions of mothering. We talk about the people who have mothered us. We also talk about what Angela gained from writing the book, how to free ourselves from shame, the relentlessness of home cooking, and why we need community. As always, the conversations on Keep Calm and Cook On are free and available for everyone. If you'd like to support the show, please take a moment to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to it, and consider signing up for my newsletter, also called Keep Calm and Cook On. The link is in the show notes, or just head to juliatertian.substack.com. Okay, on to my conversation with Angela Garbus.
I started off actually as a food writer for an alt weekly, and then I became a mother, and not meaning to, my whole career changed. And now I write about mothering and parenting, at least for now.
You're not meaning to, your career changed.
Yes.
Not you'd had kids and you didn't mean to.
No. Thankfully, that was a choice.
Oh,
also because since we're talking about it in the moment, I am someone who is proud to say that I had an abortion at a time that I needed to because I was not ready to become a mother. And that's made it possible for me to be the person and the mother and the parent that I am now. I could have had a child when I didn't mean to, but fortunately, I was able to exercise my right to bodily autonomy. So
thank you for sharing that.
Of course. Yeah. I feel like at this point, the way things are, there's no shame. I feel that I'm able to speak about those things and not everyone can. So yes, proud abortion haver.
Thank you. Something I've been doing more just in my private personal life is just talking to more people in my life who have had abortions and like hearing those stories.
Yeah.
And yeah, thanks for sharing
that.
So on that,
I know, feeling very comfortable with you, Julia. So.
Good. But I think it could be worth just grounding maybe our conversation in the work you do, just in how you define mothering. Like what does that word mean?
Sure. So I believe that raising children is a social responsibility. It is obviously the bulk of that work falls on parents and people who are raising the children like in their home, or maybe their biological parents or adoptive parents, people who choose that life. But they can't do it alone. We just can't do it alone. We can't get through life on our own. And the work of parenting is relentless. And when I think about the work, I think about, you know, mother and motherhood are nouns. We usually think of them as nouns. And to me, that feels sort of static. And the daily reality of being a mother and my mothering is in action. It's repeated action. It's cleaning, it's cooking, it's hugging, it's loving, it's tending. So I like mothering as a verb. And I also like it because it is not mother specific. It is not parent specific. It's not gender specific. Mm-hmm. And you know, my first book was a book about pregnancy, and it's called Like a Mother. And I heard from quite a few people who said, you know, I value your book and it meant a lot to me, but as someone who does not identify as a mother, someone who is gender nonconforming, I felt really left out. And I felt like you rely on gendered language. And I really took that to heart. You know, that's something that I definitely am still learning and understanding. And I wanted to find a way to have a very inclusive term. And, you know, I'm not the first person to say this. There's a journalist who I really admire, Danny McLean, and a writer, Alexis Pauline Gums, who have talked about mothering as an action and as something that's future-oriented and can involve everyone. And I just really like that. I want to welcome as many people in as possible. And I also feel that it costs me nothing to talk about mothering. I can still have my private attachment to the term mother, and it can have all of those meanings for me. But to be able to use a word that more people feel included in is really important.
I appreciate so much, especially as someone who does not have human children, mm-hmm. a lot of pets. I appreciate the generosity of that definition, and it's definitely made me think of how I just operate with different people in my life, yeah. and how other people have mothered me. And I'm wondering for you, like, you talk in Essential Labor, I mean, you talk a lot about your mother, mm-hmm. but who have been some of your other, I guess, mothers? Like, who are other people who have mothered you, to use the verb?
Yeah, I always read, I'm the kind of person that reads the acknowledgments of a book before I read.
Oh,
yeah,
it's okay. The first thing I read,
So it was really nice. I got to, well, I love, because I just get to thank all the people that made it possible, because writing a book is a very, the work is so solitary, but you cannot do it. Again, like, you can't do it alone. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But some of the people who, you know, most significantly, I would say, who have mothered me is, there was a woman who I called Nana, who I grew up calling Nana, who was my nursery school teacher. And she was an older white woman who was Irish Catholic. Nan McCluskey was her name. And my parents were immigrants from the Philippines, and they lived in a really small town. And my mom, dad worked full time. And Nan McCluskey, all three of us went to preschool. I have two older brothers. And she mm-hmm. would also, like, watch us after nursery school when my parents were still working. And I remember cookies, and we used to make milk green on St. Patrick's Day, which I did not understand, but that was Nan's thing. So Nan was definitely someone who mothered me. I had an amazing high school English teacher who is also my speech and debate coach. Her name is Anna Kelbig, and she just, you know, nurtured my love of words and my love of writing. My best friend in high school is a woman named Lisa Bates. We were some of the only people of color in our small town, and we just took care of each other. We had each other's mm-hmm. back. And then I would also say my college roommates, these four women, Patty, Avi, Claire, and Reagan, who I went to college with, again, like, they are still mothering me. Yeah. And I mean, there's been multiple people, and I guess there's so many people. Could I go on? Right. Like,
if I didn't name you, you know who you are.
Yeah. No, my editor at The Stranger, when I was working as a food writer, her name is Kathleen Richards. She's a Korean American woman who really helped me feel like I had a safe place to explore the ideas about food and identity that I wanted to when I was just sort of figuring that out. So those are some of, like, the people. And I'm still being mothered by my friends, Alex and Angie, every day. Yeah. Well, I want to ask you some questions, if that's allowed. Because I think of the work of cooking and food and recipe development, and I know you farm and garden. I think of those things as being part of mothering. And I wondered if you could just sort of talk about how you see that now, and then if you'd be willing to talk about a couple of people who mothered you in your life.
Yeah. I have been just so moved by your book and reading it, and it's helped me, like, really think about what are the terms I use to think about what I do. And using the term mothering, or being invited to use that term, has been really, like, interesting and, like, pretty, I don't know, in some ways sort of healing for me and just expansive. And I feel like the work I do in food And by work, I mean, like, sure, yeah, professional, like writing cookbooks and teaching cooking classes and stuff, but also just like the daily labor I do in making
because
food.
It is labor. Yes.
You know, it's to look at that through the lens of mothering just is really interesting to me. And I feel like it has made it feel even more purposeful in a certain way. Mm. And just to think about food and cooking and plenty of other things. But I mean, that's what I spend most of my time doing. But to think about it as caretaking, like I think of mothering as a form of caretaking.
Yes, exactly.
And I think that is something you speak to so beautifully.
And, you know, the book is primarily about mothering young children, but I am trying to just expand that as well. And I think about, I mean, I'm such a big fan of yours, so I've been like aware of what you do for years now. And I remember you were cooking with older women and older people. Mm-hmm. And I think about that as mothering too. Like it's just really caretaking with people who need a little extra love and care from people who have a little to give.
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate that. And I feel like that kind of like intergenerational thing, I think, is such a interesting aspect of mothering. Like one generation either taking care of the younger generation or looking after an older generation or finding yourself on either side of that. And then, to your question about like who has mothered me, I mean, I love feeling your sort of acknowledgments page come to life. Like it's like the CD liner notes. but I mean, the first person to come to my mind in addition to my parents is Jenny, who was my babysitter from when I was 3 until I was 13 years old. Mm-hmm. And my parents worked full time since before I was born. So I absolutely think of Jenny as another parent. And I've written about Jenny a lot, and Jenny continues to be one of the most important people in my life, and we continue to be very, very close. And we're having the experience now that I think a lot of parents have with, or a lot of, excuse me, children have with their parents as their parents age, where the caretaking kind of changes a little bit from, you know, them taking care of you to you taking care of them. But still them taking care of
right,
me.
Of course.
And
but it's nice to be able to think that you could never repay the debt. And I don't know that, I don't want to speak for Jenny, but it might not be a debt to be repaid, but it's nice to feel that you can do something for them and care for them.
Absolutely. And, you know, the particulars of our relationship include things like Jenny doesn't have any biological children of her own. Neither do I. I think that's like sort of an important thing to know in terms of our relationship and the kind of roles we fill for each other. We live within a few hours of each other. Like I'm able to see her in person. So those things I think are important. But I think there's something, I don't know, broader about our relationship that maybe applies to like more people. And for me, the thing I think about so much is like, you can be parented, you can be mothered by someone who is not related to you
at all.
And
yeah.
That person can stay in your life. And especially for me as a queer person, like the idea of chosen family is something I think about a lot. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that was kind of baked into my childhood in this way that I didn't even realize, you know, I would never have the vocabulary for it, like 4 or 5 years old. But now when I think about my family, I think about my parents, I think about the people who have mothered me, you know, Jenny is at the top of that list, and that allows me as someone, as an adult who does not have children, to think about my role in like my friends' kids' lives, like kids, you know, my niece, like people like that. Like, because I think about how many adults were in my life as a child who were instrumental in raising me, and I would be so different without them. And so who do I have the opportunity to be that for? You know, I think about that. So, yeah, as I read your book, I was just thinking about Jenny so much.
Yeah, I love that. So, I mean, when I knew that I had a chance to talk to you, I was like, and, you know, the secret is that before the podcast, I asked Julia, I was like, can we talk about Jenny? Is it okay if I ask you about Jenny? Because I'm really moved by that. And I also think that sometimes people who grow up with class privilege or who have someone in their life, you know, and like Jenny is a Black woman, right? Like sometimes people feel like they're supposed to be ashamed of that or are supposed to be self-conscious. Mm. And I think there's a lot of silence around that. And I'm not saying it's simple, you know, but I've always appreciated that you center her as someone in your life. And, you know, whatever type of way you may have felt about it, or, you know, I'm sure you've processed different feelings, but I just think we all need to be honest. You know, for your parents to have lived their life and done their jobs, they needed help, right?
Absolutely.
And I think it's, to me, we don't get anywhere without acknowledging that stuff, you know, and I think that it's... I mean, it's just important, and I don't think everyone is comfortable talking about it, and that's why I'm really glad that you are.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that, and it's something that feels, yeah, valuable to me for all the reasons you just said, and it also just feels, like, true.
Yeah.
Like, Jenny's a really important person in my life, and in my cookbooks, what I'm going to include in a cookbook, it has to be attached to a story.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, someone else can write the chicken soup or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So for me, it comes down to those stories, and those stories are about people in my life, and Jenny's one of the most important. So it feels really nice to have the opportunity to talk about that relationship and to, maybe create some visibility for that type of relationship, even though it comes with the complicated layers of class and race and everything you're talking about. Yeah, because I was a wealthy white kid being... very much raised by my Black babysitter, which is complicated.
It is. But that's the other thing is that, you know, a lot of this book is about how we make care work invisible. And in doing so, it's like, you know, it's especially dangerous because in this country, care work tends to be outsourced to women of color who are often, like right now, like domestic workers are the lowest paid worker. They're the lowest median wage of any worker in this country. So I think it is really important. Like, yes, it is complicated and we're not going to like figure everything out right in this one conversation, but it really is like people who are willing to lead and talk about these women of color who have been part of their lives, who help them or who have helped them for us to really get anywhere in terms of honoring this work and honoring these people properly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's, this is a relationship and the kind of like spider web of relationships within my family that I just think about personally all the time. But like discussing it with you makes me think about, in some ways, my relationship with Jenny is really simple. I think Jenny's relationship with my parents might be more complicated than it is with me.
Yeah.
But that's something I talk to my parents about, I talked to Jenny about. The only thing that I feel that I struggle with, that I feel myself right now, like thinking about while I'm talking to you, which is something I try not to do, is I have received Jenny's blessing to talk about Jenny in my work. And I have asked Jenny if she wants to be part of those conversations in any way. Like, I would love to do like a podcast episode with Jenny. And she is just not interested, which I totally respect.
Yeah, good for her. She's got her boundaries.
And, she's like, no. So I wouldn't talk about her if she wasn't comfortable with me, or she hadn't told me she was comfortable with me talking about her. But then I also feel like in situations like this, sometimes I feel a little like, am I talking on her behalf or something? So that is also where my head goes. But yeah, from my perspective, I just feel like, why wouldn't I include her in a conversation about how I was raised? And why would that be something I would keep hidden in any way? Because that just wouldn't be the truth.
And well, I think that there's and that's not the standard in this country, is all I'm saying.
Yeah.
And now also out of respect for Jenny, I suppose we can move forward.
Well, I love hearing about that detail you just shared earlier about with Nan about dyeing the milk green on St. Patrick's Day and you being like, I don't know what we're doing.
My parents were like, what is this?
Because it makes me think actually so much of my relationship with Jenny as a kid and so much of it to this day centers on food. And food is, I think, definitely our love language between each other. Like when I go see Jenny, she has to know when I'm coming so she can bake bread and cake ahead of time to send me home with. Like she gets very upset if she doesn't have like advanced notice. You know, there's a million other like details about food. And I think about being a kid with her. And, you know, I mentioned some of the ways we're so different, but the moments I felt most connected to Jenny were when we were eating together and we were eating the food that she would either bring from home for herself or she would prepare in my family's home for herself. And then she would share it with me. Like the passage in your book about your children eating the mackerel with you and your husband and then eating the eyeballs. Like, I was this little white Jewish kid who was like eating the eyeballs out of like the fish curry with Jenny.
Love it.
And she would let me have one and she would have the other. And I just felt so close to her in that moment. So food being this way to know her and to better learn about myself. I mean, I feel like that is just the thing that drives me every single day.
Yeah.
And I was struck by, I wrote down what page, what was it? Page 3 in your book. So right at the beginning, in the introduction, you said, I was curious about who I was, who I really was. I was hungry, desirous of my Filipina identity. So talking about appetites.
Yeah.
Is understanding yourself an appetite you have? Would you say that?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I haven't actually thought of it that way. And it's probably an insatiable appetite. I feel like I'm in a fairly sated moment. You know, I'm like 44. Mm. I feel like I've done a lot of work. Writing this book helped me. I didn't know what I was doing when I wrote this book. I was like, oh, I'm writing a history of caregiving. And I'm thinking about mothering as a way of, you know, approaching positive social change. But really, like, it ended up being so much about my family history. And only afterwards, I said to my husband the other night, I was like, this sounds very dramatic. I was like, but I think this book sort of saved me. Like, because in writing about, helped me make peace with the people I come from, the person that I am, how I want to mother, how I'm continuing to mother myself. Like, I feel after writing this book that I know who I am right now. Very solidly.
Mm.
Yeah. But I think it's because I...
What an amazing thing.
Yeah. But I think I indulged my appetite by writing this book in that way. For sure.
That's really cool to think about it that way. And I am so struck by, like, it makes so much sense to me to hear that because of the way I perceive this book to be landing.
Mm.
And I think it is resonating for so many people. And I think it's because, yes, you wrote about social change. You wrote about, like, political, cultural change. And I think the reasons it's hitting for so many of us is because it's personal. Mm. It's because you were vulnerable and you did work through so much in the book and you shared so much. And I feel like, for me, like, that is how I am moved and moved to action. Right?
Yeah.
When there's like a person behind it, and then you realize that person could also be you. I'm so glad that is so cool to just look at you right now and listen to you just be like, I know who I am. Like, that's amazing.
Yeah,
that's,
it's cool. It
I
is really
have,
cool.
Like, a moment
I feel
for
like,
that.
No, yes, let's have the moment. Because I've done a lot of work to get here.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I expect I'm going to have to do a lot of work to like make it through my life. But, yeah, it feels really good. Like, thank you for, you know, like, you've created a space where I can say that.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're very welcome. And I feel like, you know, the one thing I've learned to expect is just change. But I feel like for me personally, like, if I can have a moment like the one you just had, like, if I have that in my back pocket when I'm not feeling that secure, I can be like, well, I do know what it feels like.
Yeah.
Like, I've had that experience.
Totally.
So.
Yeah. No, I'll be like keeping this in my pocket to rub like a little stone from the beach, you know, like on a bad day.
Oh, amazing. Okay. You also said in a chapter that really struck me, chapter 6, Mothering as Encouraging Appetites. I know this chapter also, like, I've seen a lot of people say, like, this chapter in particular really got me. So you said, my appetite has always felt outsized, and I've only ever wanted to indulge it. And then I noticed later in that chapter, you said appetites, plural. Mm. So I'm wondering about your plural appetites.
Yeah.
Like, what are some of your appetites?
So,
how would you describe
them? Yeah, that's such a insightful pickup. So the first one is definitely in regard to like my like eating appetite as a child, which was very, has always been robust. And, you know, as a kid too, you know, being a kid who likes to eat a lot is encouraged. Like, you're healthy and you're cleaning your plate and you're good. And then it gets a little more complicated, of course, like as you reach adolescence. And I know you've written about this and talked about this, it becomes so much more complicated, especially for young mm-hmm. women, where suddenly mm-hmm. having an appetite is discouraged, and expanding and growing are discouraged. Yeah. But as far as my other appetites, like I would say I have a very, very deep appetite for physical pleasure mm-hmm. that comes in many different forms, from touching to dancing to moving my body, from being in company with people, from getting a massage or getting a Korean spa scrub or soaking in a hot tub, jumping in cold bodies of water. I mean, I could go on. So like physical pleasure. Yeah, that's for sure. You know, as I get older, I do this less, but like, I've never had much moral judgment around, despite the culture and even within my own family. Like, you know, I think like drinking, I understand like there's, you know, it's complicated. You know, these are health mm-hmm. issues, and addiction, right, is like a problem. It's a health issue. It's, mm-hmm. but it's not like a moral thing for me, right? And mm-hmm. so like drinking and like taking some drugs and like having a mind expanding experience, which people do have done for centuries throughout the world, like that's never felt fraught for me. That's always felt mm-hmm. fun, right? Like if done safely and like in good company.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think those are like the main things I would sort of say that I was thinking about when I was writing that. You know, all of the appetites, like being an animal, being like a physical animal, not wanting to think too much about anything, wanting to sort of exit my brain and be in my body. Really mm-hmm. the appetites that I feel are discouraged in mm-hmm. us, and especially, I'd say especially females. Yeah, those are the things that I've always felt. I just didn't like being told that I couldn't do those things.
So is like, are your appetites, do they come out of defiance, or are they just...
I'm sure, you know, this is like, that's the question. I think sometimes, sometimes they've come out of defiance. Sometimes they've come out of just an understanding of who I am. Mm-hmm. They've come from just desire, right? Mm-hmm. They've also come in, you know, at times in my life, they've come from a desire to numb myself to mm-hmm. pain mm-hmm. And to difficulty. They've come from, you know, like wanting to hide. You know, I grew up in a family where, like, I mean, my parents just, like, bathed me in unconditional love, but we have a very large cultural divide. I mean, there are immigrants from the Philippines. They're devoutly Catholic. You know, like, they had me, and I was like, I'm a feminist at age 12, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. I was, you know, definitely, like, pro-choice, right? Like, and when, mm-hmm. when the debate was, like, pro-choice, pro-life. And I think there is part of me that has always felt, like, I've felt this way in my, definitely in my, like, relationship and marriage with my husband, like I've always sort of doubted, like love isn't enough, like he's never going to understand me. So it's sort of like I can sort of hide a little bit and hide myself. Mm-hmm. And so those things come from there too. I think it's it comes from all places, you know. And what I'm trying to do is accept who I am and live in like a healthy balance, right? Like I can't stop myself from having urges that are like motivated mm-hmm. by weakness or challenges that mm-hmm. I have in my life, mm-hmm. nor do I want to stop myself from having urges that are based in things that make me feel really good and connected to other people in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I there's so much to think about in everything you just said. I just think it's honestly just, it's so rare to hear someone, but especially a woman, and especially like a woman of color, to name your desires, to know them, and to vocalize them and be like unapologetic about them. That in and of itself is like a powerful thing to do. So cool.
Thank you.
Thanks for doing it.
You know, I think some of it is that I feel more bold, like in the last, I think when my first book came out, I probably wouldn't have spoken so openly. I mean, mm-hmm. Certainly not all of me is in this book. It could not contain all of me, right? But but one of the things that's really made a difference to me in the last few years is I wrote this book, and I've heard from so many women who are like first generation Filipino American like me. And, you know, like I have this sort of platform, like people listen to what I have to say. And it's that sort of made me bold, because I feel like I wanted someone like this talking about these things. And so I feel mm-hmm. I find myself like in a position where I could not, but then I think, like, if anything that I'm doing is, like, giving people a little bit of permission or feeling, like, a little bit more like they can do that, then that seems really, that seems valuable, you know? It's not just because I'm like, oh, it's so interesting. Like, it's very much, I don't know. I think it's part of my, like, it was, you know, the idea of, like, being useful and being of service in some way. I couldn't just be. I would have to be, like, of service in some way. But there is a part of that that makes me feel more comfortable talking about things.
It makes a lot of sense for me when I think about, you know, you mentioned before that, like, stuff around kind of, like, diet culture and stuff is stuff, like, I've kind of written about or talked about. And I found that the moment I was willing to kind of do that work for myself, not just like on myself, but for myself to like really examine diet culture, what it is and how gripped I was by it and how steeped I was in it, to see that for just what it is and how harmful it is. And, you know, to see that, to work to get myself out of it, to take some accountability for how I contributed to it. And just to talk about all of this, like, that has been kind of, I would say, like, a shift in my work. And I felt like a little, it felt very vulnerable to do that. And, but doing that, I have, the conversations I've had since I've started doing that in my work, like the conversations I've had with, you know, people who have read things I've written or whatever, have been so powerful. And at times when I feel a little maybe like hopeless or lost in that kind of healing work, it has given it a sense of purpose because there's connection.
We're so not alone in our particular journeys. And so much of stuff about our bodies, you know, we're not really encouraged to talk about it. So it feels, it's so much easier for that stuff to feel private and shameful. And then you realize that there are so many people who are going through this and not in the exact way, but like who can connect on this level. And that's, it feels really great. It feels, it's one of the things that I love best about this work.
Yeah. I feel like realizing the experiences you've had that have made you, I'm not talking specifically about you, but have made one feel shame when you realize, or I'll just talk about myself. When I have realized that I'm not the only one who has felt that, and I've talked to other people about that, like that to me just evaporates shame in a way that is so powerful. And I feel like is such a powerful force against the forces that created that shame. Like when I think about diet culture, I'm like, well, diet culture is white supremacy. Like it's capitalism, it's perfectionism. It's like, it's saying white people are better. It's saying, you know, all these things. So it's like taking away that shame is just, it's a really powerful tool. Like, yes, it's healing, but also it's like, it's galvanizing. I feel like you do that in your book in so many ways.
Thank you. I mean, I think the thing that I want to pick up on that is that when we feel shame, so shame really thrives in silence. Right? Like in that sort of privatized shame, as I was saying. And then I ask myself always, like, who benefits from this silence? It's not Julia and Angela and like people like us. It is all of those forces that you just named. And the culture benefits, like this white supremacist, like heteronormative, racist, you know, this culture, the capitalist, extractive, exploitative culture benefits from us being quiet. And that idea of like, I know I'm not like changing the world, right, by writing my book, but like, I'm helping people and I'm helping myself. And in helping and healing, it makes it possible for us to like come together, as you said, galvanizing or to like get rid of some shame and find that you have some energy to put towards community or something else, right? It is again, like it's choosing to not be complicit. It's choosing to take a stand against it.
It is so interesting to me to hear you say, I know I'm not changing the world, because how are you defining change? If it's being defined in these capitalism terms, like maybe you're not. But if it's being defined as helping people feel connected, helping create community, helping release shame, that is like the type of currency I'm like very interested in.
Okay. Yeah. Well, then I think, I guess there's like a little bit of like, what do you want to claim? You don't want to take too like, I don't want to think too highly of myself here, Julia, you know, like, but that's the sort of change that I'm talking about too. And I think it is like, it's not, maybe I think about it like this. Like, I feel like I am contributing to changing. And I feel like that's my purpose here. Like it's, if I'm not doing, I mean, I love to write. It's a creative exercise for me. It's something that gives me pleasure and satisfaction. But I also feel that my reason for being here is to try to make things better, even just like a smidge for a few people. And, you know, I think about that for my daughters for sure, but also like for my community. And like, yeah, you're right. Like it's about how you choose to term things. And I don't think that the things that I want, like to go back to the beginning to talk about like full body autonomy, you know, and like free abortion on demand for everyone who wants it, right? Free healthcare. I don't know if those things are going to happen while I'm alive, right? That doesn't mean I'm not going to try to fight for those things. And I also feel that one of the most, like, I'm not, I love people who are like fighting for us, like on Capitol Hill, who can find the strength to like even engage in this government that I feel is just feel so distanced from democracy, right? But I think like my skills are person to person, hand to hand, one on one. And I lean into that. And it's not, it is sort of outside of, you know, market relations or in any way that feels measurable, I guess.
Yeah.
But it feels good to me. It's the work that maybe people don't see, but that's what my life's about.
And that has value.
Yes.
It really does.
Thank you.
I don't know. I feel like when you're saying like who benefits from it, like I feel like I ask like the even more crass question all the time, which is like who's making money?
Yeah, no, totally. Yes.
Like, and just like follow the money. I hope she doesn't mind me doing this, but I got into a thing with my mom recently because my mom, I think she'll be okay. I'll run it by her.
Yeah. With consent always.
Yes. So my mom is on her own journey within diet culture. And she was telling me about like she didn't feel like she was getting enough steps.
Oh, like, yeah.
On her step counter. She's in her late 70s. She is very, very lucky to live like in a very healthy functioning body. And I was just so bothered by hearing her talk about like not getting enough fucking steps. And then I was like, who told you you need to get 10,000 steps? And she was like, well, that's just like what we need to do. And then so like I sent her the article about like the marketing campaign that originated.
No, I was 10,000 like, step thing. Did the device tell you that you needed like 10,000 steps?
And I was like, who is making money off of you thinking that? Like the companies that are making the pedometers, like you don't like, and it was like this whole thing, but that was a recent example. Anyway.
Yeah. Like your Fitbit, your Apple Watch. It's, yeah. Where is that? Where's the degree, that decree of like what is healthy and what you need to do every day? Where does that come from? It's not coming from inside, you know, like we all have different definitions of what feels right for movement in our bodies to be healthy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I feel like the question is like not just who's benefiting or who's making money, but it's also another layer to that is like who is benefiting from you continuing to feel like you are not doing what you're supposed to be doing or you're not doing enough, and who's keeping you in that position to keep themselves in this more powerful position.
Yeah.
Okay. You were talking earlier about the relentlessness of parenting.
Mm-hmm.
And when I hear the word relentless, the first thing I think of is cooking.
Yes.
Because cooking, especially home cooking, is a relentless thing to do. And this is coming from a person who's written many cookbooks about home cooking and who cooks every single day and who loves cooking. And I think it is relentless and often undervalued, underappreciated, but also incredibly purposeful and just totally endless.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I make dinner, I'm like, oh, I'm gonna do this again. Like, I'm going to make breakfast tomorrow. I'm gonna, like, it just doesn't stop. And hearing you describe parenting that way makes so much sense to me and makes me come back to this idea of appetite, because I think our appetites are the same. They're relentless.
Yes.
Like you mentioned earlier, feeling like you're at this sort of, like, sated point. Like, you feel like your appetite has been met. So the thing with appetites is just the same as with parenting or cooking. Like, once you're full, you will be hungry again.
Right.
And this is just life, right? To like, to get through a day and be lucky enough to have another day, it's like you have to get through that next day. And I guess my question is, how do you reconcile this relentlessness? Like, what's the first thing to come to your mind?
I mean, it's to give yourself a break wherever you can get it, and to ask for help. Those are the things that I didn't, I mean, I used to just talk about, I mean, I love home cooking. You know, like that's, and I'm a very confident home cook. I love doing it. But I think, you know, the pandemic was really challenging for even people who love cooking mm-hmm. because you didn't have the option of catching a break for a long mm-hmm. time. And so I definitely felt like I'm seeing, I would just be like standing at the stove again. And I felt like I was literally seeing the color run out of like a wok of pad thai. I was like, it used to bring me pleasure. And now it's just like gray mm-hmm. and the monotonous, right? Mm-hmm. And so I also like, I just don't, my husband is the kind of person, like he grew up on welfare. You know what I mean? His mom, mm-hmm. who I never met, she passed away before we ever met. She used to order, I mean, she raised 5 kids on a very tight budget. She used to basically order from like the Cisco truck. She would place a bulk order like every 4 months, which first of all, talk about the labor that goes into that, right? Yeah. But it would be like, you would have 2 slices of like paper thin ham for your sandwich. Like that's what he talks about. And so uh-huh. when we met, I was working as a food writer and I was just like, let's eat, let's have this pork belly, right? Mm-hmm. And he was like, calories. It's just calories to get mm-hmm. through the day. And it was like, we sort of learned from each other. I have become a lot less precious about food, mm-hmm. you know, like mm-hmm. I feel like my like cooking sweet spot is like the intersection of like improvisation and thrift now, you know, and mm-hmm. like leftovers. Mm-hmm. And so that relentlessness to me is like, it's finding ways to cut yourself a break. Like we've been doing more takeout, you mm-hmm. know, or frozen type foods because it's expensive feeding a family of 4. Yeah. And I just don't have guilt or I don't feel any type of way about it because we are also not meant to be cooking. Like breakfast, lunch, and dinner and snacks mm-hmm. every single day. Like I think before when we lived communally, right? Like before we were all in our nuclear families, mm-hmm. we shared food more. And so I lean more into that. We have family meals with the family that we became really close to during the pandemic. Now that things are opening up a little bit mm-hmm. with care, we're having more like dinners and get-togethers where we collectively ignore our multiple children. So I think that's part of it. And that also gives me pleasure because it's that camaraderie and coming together and connection with food. I'd say that's the number one thing is like, I give myself a break because it's just too much.
Yeah. Has that been, a hard thing for you to learn how to do?
Oh yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I mean, my sweet spouse would make like a tofu stir fry and I'd like have notes on the like texture of you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And now mm-hmm. I'm just like, just so grateful to have somebody else cook food. You know what I mean? Like, I think, that's not just like letting go. That's me just relaxing and chilling the F out because I was kind of a dick about it, right? Like, mm-hmm. But I've had to learn, you know, one of the things that's a big part of this book is this insistence on interdependence. We just mm-hmm. need each other, which is, I know, something I said at the top. But I've had to ask for help and to understand that, like, sometimes even the people who know me well, even the person that loves me most, like, he or they don't know what I need or want all the time. I have to tell them. Mm-hmm. And for someone who grew up being like, I have to be self-sufficient, I have to be independent, I have to be strong, I have to like prove myself, to make myself vulnerable in that way it's been something that I've been working on actively for like 12 years.
Yeah. I used to keep a post-it note above the sink in the kitchen because that is a spot where I am.
Yes.
So it was a spot I would see it. And the post-it note said, Grace cannot read your mind. You cannot read Grace's mind.
Right. And you can't be expected to.
I needed the reminder. I needed the reminder.
Yeah. And
I eventually took it down because I think I got it.
Yeah. You were like made penetrated. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think that's, we need to be told. And I think also in love, right, which is also is like the work of caring and being in love with someone and loving them in that way is also relentless, not in a way mm-hmm. that is bad, but I like to think that it provides like so many opportunities for growth and connection. But it took me a while to be like, no, you should just know how I want to be loved, right? Or how I want to be cared for. But because it feels like unromantic to have to say mm-hmm. it. But then mm-hmm. I'm like, I just need to say it so we can get on with it, so that we can get to a moment that feels romantic instead of me being silently resentful and then the other person is quiet and confused. You know, like,
the narrative that has been just like drilled into us about romance of someone, being able to read your mind and know what you want before you even know what you want, and just providing that and being this like,
or to be everything that you need. They cannot be. They never will be. Like, that's why we need community, right? Like, and that's why this sort of monogamous, specific sort of cis normative heteronormative relationship that is shoved down our throats. I think most of us want. I mean, I'm not saying everyone's going to like reorient their whole families, but I don't know. I feel like my kids are growing up with a more expansive idea of what love and commitment and family is. They see it. It's just around us. Mm-hmm. And I think most of us probably want more, you know, and you know, you can still have your like one partner, you can still be married, but I think to realize that you can get love, like platonic love, right? And care and like intergenerational, all of that stuff. Like we need all of it and we deserve all of it. We cannot ask one person to provide that for us.
100%. I feel like that's another thing Grace and I tell each other and remind each other all the time. Like the amount of times I've said to Grace, like, I love you so much. And I need to remember that you can't be everything for me and I can't be everything for you. And those things can exist at the same time.
Totally. Yeah.
Like, yeah. And that has just been something I've had to learn because that's not something I necessarily knew before. So getting there.
Yeah.
And talking about just wanting more, which I love when you talk about this stuff, it makes me think, how do you differentiate between appetite and greed?
Oh, I see it as like, appetite to me is like, I'm going to get mine, right? Like, and it's tuned into my particular desires and it's like listening to myself and knowing also when I am full, like, you know, like I can glut a little bit and I'm probably a little overindulgent, right? But to me, it's like about like, it's getting mine for me, right? In a way that makes me feel good. And to me, greed is like, I got mine and now I need yours and yours, right? Like I do think like we don't need, we created poverty. Poverty is a man-made thing. Mm-hmm. And so it was like being a trillionaire, right? Like, so to me, greed is like unchecked, right? Like an unchecked sort of desire, or actually not even like, you don't know, or it's driven by some. This is such a good question. I don't totally know, right? Like, I think even in my appetites, I never I just like locating myself in some sense of a collective. That's really important to me, and I'm willing to like tamp down my appetites if it means that I get to like be in a better relationship and other people get theirs, right?
Yeah.
And then I think, you know, greed is really not, it's not thinking about anyone else.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's, I think that's what I'm getting at.
Yeah, I am agreeing.
I was going to say, what do you think?
With this definition. Yeah, no, I don't know. I feel like so much of your book talking about the like history of just the Philippines and your family's particular history, like both there and in America, you know, had me just thinking so much about, you know, reading so much and then thinking so much about colonialism. Mm. And I am just thinking, as I'm conducting this handful of interviews, I'm thinking so much about this just idea of appetite. And maybe I'm putting too much on this word and overthinking
No, I don't. I don't think so. I feel like, you know, to talk specifically, I don't know if you had a specific question there.
No, I was like, oh, is that like, is colonialism like appetite gone way out of hand?
Yeah. Like, I mean, I think it actually is like greed. A betrayal. Yeah. I think appetite is natural, right? Appetite is not something that has to be, I think it should be celebrated, right? Like, and taught to manage, right? In a way that is healthy and can serve everyone, right? Or ensure that everyone can get what they need. But I think, colonialism to me is, and colonial capitalism especially is, you know, the Philippines was an American colony. We don't often talk about this, but it was an American colony for the first half of the 20th century. And to me, colonization is like you go in, like wherever it is happening in the world, is like you go to another land and you say, hey, actually, like I know better than you. And you take control of like resources and you extract that. Mm-hmm. And so that's like a, you know, a real perverse sort of like it's greed. But it's that extraction and consumption. And so that's why, I think it's unchecked consumption, which to me is different than appetite. Right, yeah. I guess.
And I think like being extractive and not additive, like
and
selfish, not community driven, like all these kind of, I don't know, I guess binaries, but Yeah, it's just, it's interesting, I feel like, on this topic to talk about, like, what happens when it goes in the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you to do something that might be super uncomfortable and you can say no?
Okay.
Which is, would you read a paragraph of your book?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Okay.
Totally.
I feel like that can be awkward, but I would rather you do it than me do it. Like,
what is the paragraph?
Okay. I wrote down, it starts on page 103.
Okay.
It's the final paragraph of chapter 4.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally.
And
I love this
love
paragraph.
To hear you read this.
Sure.
And then I have one question, but first read.
Okay. So starting, I want more. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I want more friends, more casual impromptu hangs, more dropping by with dinner, more walking and talking and advice sessions, more kids underfoot, more asking for and saying what we need, more hands to carry heavy boxes, more laughing and cackling and snorting, more children farting at the dinner table, more of what makes life messy, less painful, more sweet. I want to give and receive, to always be swapping Tupperware and food, all of us crowded together like curvy lumpen mangoes in a baking dish.
Thank you so
much.
Yeah,
you're so welcome.
My question about that just beautiful passage, because you write books a while before they come into the mm-hmm. world. is there anything in this moment you would want to add to that list?
Oh, I mean, aside from like paid family leave, universal health care, universal basic income, no. I mean, I feel like that gets to like
it's
the
there.
Feeling of being nourished and cared for. And, you know, if that's like what I get in like a day or like in a month of my life, I feel really, I'd be so happy and so content with that.
Yeah. That's awesome. I could talk to you honestly for like 6 hours.
You know, I
like
feel the same way.
Stand up. I feel like this conversation opens so many more questions, but I want to be respectful of your time. So I'm just going to ask you the final question that I ask everyone who's kind enough to come on my podcast. I feel like you gave numerous answers to this question in the book.
Okay.
But in this moment, without overthinking it, first thing to come to mind, when you were a little kid, little Angela, mm-hmm. what was your favorite thing to eat?
Oh, I grew up in central Pennsylvania, and I had this thing for something called Scrapple, mm-hmm. which is mm-hmm. like, I haven't had it in a long time, but it's like force meat and like ground mm-hmm. up bits, I think pork. And it's very, very peppery. And mm-hmm. you would buy it in like a slab. It was like a long rectangle. And then you would slice it really thin and then griddle it. And I just loved it. And we would have it for breakfast. And it's a very like, I don't know if it's like a Pennsylvania Dutch thing or.
Yeah, I believe it is.
Yeah. I live on the West Coast now. I live in Seattle and I haven't had it for probably like 30 years, but I can taste it because it was like black pepper. And it was kind of, it's one of those great texture combinations where it's really soft on the inside, but like super crispy on the outside. Mm-hmm. And because we're Filipino, we had it with rice, which I don't, is not like the traditional way to do it. But yeah, that was, that really got me going when I was a kid.
Oh, yeah. I love it.
Like, I would get out of bed for Scrapple.
I feel like it's like a cousin to like Spam and eggs.
Yes.
Or, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And Spam is something that, you know, like Hawaiians and Filipinos are super familiar with. So I think like that sort of, mm-hmm. that kind of canned meat mm-hmm. felt very, and not that this was canned, but like, I think for people like from the Philippines in central Pennsylvania, my parents were like, oh, we know what that is. Like, we understand this. Like, let's get this Scrapple stuff. Yeah.
Is it something you said you haven't had it in so long?
Like,
do you want it? Or is it just nice to have as a memory?
I my guess is that it's probably a better food memory than going back to it. I don't know that I need to revisit it, but I'm so glad that I had it. You know what I mean? Like, I think I'd rather preserve the beauty of Scrapple in my mind.
Yeah. I feel like there's certain things that I revisit and I'm like, yeah, this really was so good. And then there's certain things where I was like, why did I need to mess with this?
I recently had a backyard barbecue just this past weekend, which is like just to be able to see friends again. It's so, so wonderful. Friends we hadn't seen in a while. Mm. But I had a Capri Sun lemonade. And I got to tell you, that held up. It did not taste bad. And I definitely, like, I took a sip of my daughter's and I was like, well, I'm going to go get one of those from the cooler.
Yeah. Good for you. Yeah. Did you make a mess when you punched?
Yes. I still haven't figured out how to do that, like, competently.
Yeah, I don't know that anyone does. Amazing. Angela, I can't thank you enough. I looked forward to this hour like so much. I've been counting down the days, and just thank you for your work. It's super important.
Oh, thank you. I feel the same way. And it's so wonderful to connect and meet you, and I look forward to future conversations.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you.
Thank you so much to Angela for her time and thoughtfulness. And thank you for listening to our conversation. Please remember to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to this podcast, and consider signing up for my newsletter, also called Keep Calm and Cook On. The link is in the show notes, or you can just head to julietertian.substack.com. I'll be back soon with the remaining three conversations in this four-part series. Until then, take care.